Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. Once again, we are live for an hour in the afternoon as we do this each weekday afternoon from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific time. If you are listening to the live broadcast, I certainly would encourage you to call and be a part of it. How would you do that or why? Well, if you're not familiar, this is an open Bible discussion where you can bring up questions you have about the Bible or about the Christian life, and we can discuss them. Now, why would you want to discuss them here? Am I saying that I know the answer to all your questions? Well, no, I certainly wouldn't say that. But I believe that the Bible does answer all of the questions that are of any importance to us. And all I can really say for myself is I've been studying the Bible for close to 50 years. I've been a teacher of the Bible for 43 years, and I've done almost nothing else but teach the Bible, teach through the Bible again and again. The 16 years I led a Bible school in Oregon, we went through the whole Bible every year. All I can say is that while there are many parts of the Bible I still don't understand completely, and there are many questions, or at least some, that I still don't know the answers to myself, that I used to have and I still have, yet over the years I have found that the Bible does answer most of the questions I used to have. And I'll be glad to share with you what I've learned from my studies. And if you hear an answer that you think is not correct or adequate, feel free to call and balance comment with your own insights. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Our first caller today is Marie, calling from an undisclosed location. Mary, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm just calling because it's a sensitive issue and it's a small community that I live in. Mm-hmm. And I just prefer to remain the city anonymous. Okay. Because it is a small community, and it's about the homosexual bill that passed that legalized marriage in Washington. Mm-hmm. Where we live, there's a lot of homosexuals that are in the community, and a lot of them are really nice, lovely people who are in the business world, who are out and about. And I know one prominent couple just got married legally. It's out there, and I think, how do we handle this? As Christians, you know, I have frequented the business that they own. I go there because I need things. I'm pleasant. They're kind people. I talk with them. The subject of homosexuality has come up. Do I say congratulations to them? This is one of those things. What do you say? It's all over. It's, you know, everybody knows. I don't know how to handle this.
First of all, it seems to me like the vote in Washington State about legalizing homosexual marriage was completely unnecessary, since Washington State had earlier passed laws that gave homosexuals every right that married couples have, with the exception of calling it marriage. So there really didn't seem to be any need to change the name for what they do, it seems to me. I mean, they gained no new rights by this bill, as I understand it, except the right to call it marriage, which I'm not sure why they wanted to do that. Marriage has a definition already, and it has always had a definition that's different than that. So the need to change it was not obvious. In any case, how can you, as a Christian citizen, react to it? Well, you should react to it the same way Jesus would, I would say. And what would he do? Well, what did he do? When Jesus was around people who were not his followers, when he was around people who were living in what he defined as sin, what did he do? He loved them, basically. Mm-hmm. And he associated in some measure with them. You know, he didn't treat them like lepers. They did not, for the most part, probably make up his band of disciples. At least among the 12, we know of only one person who came from a really scandalous background, and that was, of course, Matthew, the tax collector. Although the fishermen probably were not exactly highly coming from a trade that would be considered to be very virtuous, or I should say, what should we say, sanctified. Commercial fishermen are often pretty gruff characters. But we don't know. We don't know what his disciples were like, except for Matthew, before they became disciples. And we don't know to what degree the larger group that followed him around was made up of the most scandalous sinners in town. Some of them might have been, because they did. There were times when those very kinds of people invited him over for meals, and he did associate with them. So I would say we need to do toward them what Jesus would do. Now, if somebody is living in sin and professing to be a Christian and expecting to engage in Christian fellowship with you, I would have to say that's something that the Bible says we're not to do. It's one thing to love our neighbors. It's another thing to consider them to be the objects of Christian fellowship. Now, I believe that a person who's got struggles with homosexuality can certainly be a Christian, just like a person who's got struggles with heterosexuality.
They're not professing to be Christian.
Right. So in their case, in the case of this couple, there's nothing to do differently toward them than you do toward anyone else. In fact, what were you going to say?
I agree. I think we need to love others. We need to be kind to them.
Mm-hmm.
But does loving them include saying congratulations when I don't agree with homosexual marriage? And I think part of the reason why the whole bill passed, some of the opponents say it's because then they can push it on our kids even more, you know, that kind of stuff. I don't know. To get into the whole political thing is not my point here.
Mm-hmm.
But my point is, you know, in a small community, when I run into them, they probably know I go to church.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't necessarily congratulate them on their, perverting the meaning of marriage.
Right.
I wouldn't congratulate anyone for their sins. But then that doesn't mean you can't be friends with someone. I have neighbors around me who are not Christians. I've never specifically congratulated them for anything, but I behave in as friendly a manner to them as I would if they were Christians, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, you don't treat them like second-class human beings, but that doesn't mean you have to pretend like you're one of them or that you have, that you're glad about some specific thing in their life that you're not glad about. You don't have to pretend to be have different convictions than you have.
Mm-hmm.
You don't ever want to be ashamed of your convictions as a Christian.
Right. It gets tricky. How do we handle this as Christians?
Well,
want to go into their place of business, and it's like,
well, that's silly. I mean, if you would normally go into a place of business and it happens to be run by a couple of homosexuals, why would that be different than if it was run by a couple of atheists or a couple
right.
of Buddhists or whatever? I mean, why,
exactly.
Why would the fact that these people are homosexuals have any impact on making you more awkward
Most people don't feel that way. You know, it's learning to engage with people who are homosexuals,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, in a way. And it particularly came up with one friend of mine who is in a business that is directly involved with people who get married. And she didn't want to have to. She never in her wildest dreams felt that she would have to be involved in a way that.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, that's one thing. You know, if you're in a business, like you're a wedding photographer or a wedding planner, or a florist,
correct.
Or someone who's serving weddings directly, this would put a person in a hard spot. And in fact, I'm not sure what the law states in Washington, but it is probably illegal for these people to discriminate.
Probably so, yeah. And I know that she is particularly grieved about it. And
yeah.
That's kind of where it kind of comes into. And, you know, it could ruin your business if you, you know,
right.
You don't.
Now, you're not in that kind of business, right?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so this isn't really your problem. You're talking
no, but,
about...
But the whole thing is the mm-hmm. topic comes up as a
yeah.
as a point of discussion. And I'm in a place where I don't, in the business that I'm in, I don't have a problem at all working with them.
Uh-huh.
Because I wouldn't have a problem working, you know, so it's just...
Well, the thing about a wedding is it's a little different than just an office building.
Right.
You know, if you're working in an office with homosexual people, there's no reason why that has to ever become an issue between you. If
right.
you're working at a wedding, if you're a minister, if you're a caterer, if you're a photographer of weddings, and, you know, a couple come to you who want to get married and they want to hire you, if you don't believe that they are a couple whose wedding you can countenance, you should be able to say no. And this would not just be if they're homosexuals. There are many people who are getting married, men and women, heterosexual couples, who are getting married that I don't think have the right to get married because one of them has been illegitimately divorced or something else. In other words, if I were a minister doing weddings, I would not wish to do any wedding for any couple that I believed didn't have a legitimate claim to being married under biblical terms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now, of course, I wouldn't be surprised if certain couples, just to be nasty, and I, God forbid, that I would suggest that any homosexuals would be nasty, but there are some who are, just like there are some non-homosexuals who are. But if a couple, to be nasty, might come to a known Christian, you know, wedding planner or something like that, knowing that it would bother them, and would try to force them to do business with them and then file a lawsuit if they won't. This, of course, would just be nothing but nastiness doing this because, to tell you the truth, if I was getting married and I knew that a certain business owner didn't like my type or didn't think that it was okay for me to get married or a pastor didn't think I was legitimately free to remarry or something like that, I wouldn't go to him. You know, if I disagreed with him, I'd go to someone who agreed with me. But
mm-hmm.
there are people who are trying to make court cases happen, and they would, in some cases, target somebody who disagrees with them like this. And this is just hostility. This is the lack of civility and the lack of decency on their part. But
mm-hmm.
you know, it should be possible for anyone who is in a business related to weddings to decide whom they will serve and whom they won't.
Yeah,
there's many businesses have signs in their entry that says we reserve the right to refuse business service to anyone. And that really should be a private business owner's prerogative.
Yeah, and I don't want to call, you know, in her place at all, but it's like, as you know, I know that each of us has to be accountable to God and try to listen to Him in our specific situation, you know, and how we deal with people in that situation. And I know that we have to be loving. It says that they'll know we are Christians by our love. And it is tricky. It's just really a tricky situation.
Right.
And
but if a person says, you know, I want to play Russian roulette, and you're supposed to love me, so would you please give me the gun? I don't think being loving requires that you hand them a gun. And
right.
if somebody wants to do something that is spiritually harmful to themselves or to society, and they ask you to participate, I would think that you have every right to say no. I don't know what the law reads now up there in Washington State, but and my guess is that this new law is going to make it possible for there to be lawsuits, test cases, and so forth, and that this is going to end up being a means of official governmental persecution of Christians in the state of Washington.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to say. Well, Marie, we've been talking a long time, and I've got other calls to take.
Yeah,
but
you have other calls. Okay, thank you very much.
I appreciate your call. Have a good
thank
afternoon.
You.
Fred from Las Vegas, Nevada is next. And by the way, we have a line open for you as well. The number is 1-800-438-5090. You want to join us? Feel free to call me. 1-800-438-5090. Fred, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. That was great. Kind of interesting what the lady was saying. In New Mexico about 4 years ago, maybe three, four, there was a couple who had a photography agency, and they refused to photograph same-sex union, a lesbian union. And the state of New Mexico has a Department of Anti-Discrimination or whatever, and they were almost sued completely out of business.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Yeah, and then the pastor up in Canada a few years ago who quoted Leviticus when it talks about a man lying with a man and things of that nature, in a letter that he wrote as an editorial, was threatened with imprisonment. So
I know, and it's coming. It's coming.
Yeah, it's coming. I'm just wondering, I share with some people, when is the day that they come to all of us in Christian radio and say, you're going to have to take everybody that says they're a Christian, whether they are or not, and broadcast them. So, you know, we need to be praying. We really do. That's our weapon. That's our warfare. We're given that. It's a mighty power of God, and we know what's coming, and we just have not stood up against it in the right way, and that's with prayer. So anyway, I just wanted to put in my nickel and a half's worth.
Okay, Fred. I appreciate that.
Oh, you betcha. God bless, brother.
God bless you, too. Bye. All right. Mark from Beaverton, Oregon is next. Mark, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Well, you're not sure.
Mark? And Mark is gone. He hung up. Sometimes people hang up while they're waiting to go on, but it's a little less, you know, a little less desirable to actually go on the air and then hang up. All right, let's talk to Gage from Seattle, Washington next. Gage, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi.
Hi there,
How
Gage.
How you doing?
Good.
I just had a comment about the lady who had talked about the homosexual stuff in Washington.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, as far as I know right now, in the R-74, as far as I know, a pastor or minister would not be obligated to ordinate such homosexual marriages.
Well, that's good. But what about a florist or a photographer who isn't a 501c3 or a religious organization?
Yeah, that I don't know. I do not know.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, but I just wanted to let her know that in case she was wondering about that.
Yeah.
And, yeah, as far as I know, I mean, hopefully it doesn't happen too soon, but, you know.
Right. It's a shame that such a small percentage of the population can be so touchy as to try to eliminate the rights of the 97%.
Yeah,
now, of course,
right?
We might say, well, it's not the 3%. It's you know, 54% or whoever voted for them is. But still, I don't think that a majority in this country is allowed to vote away the rights and the freedoms of the minority. In fact, I think that's why we have a republic instead of a democracy, because we're supposed to be ruled by law, and there are laws defined in the Constitution that grant certain rights to religious people, for example, for their religious expression. And they don't have to be pastors to do that. If a person has religious convictions against something, there shouldn't be any law that says they have to go against that conviction unless that conviction's hurting somebody.
Yeah, I completely agree.
And these constitutional rights should not be able to be voted away by the majority or by anyone.
I know. I don't understand why it's such a big deal. It's just ridiculous.
Well, you know what? It's usually cast in the media as if the Christians are persecuting the homosexual community. The truth of the matter is, I don't think Christians have persecuted the homosexual community in any legal way. There might be individual Christians who've been mean or foolish or small-minded enough to persecute homosexuals. We shouldn't be persecuting anybody, homosexual or prostitute or you know, drunkard or anybody. We shouldn't be. Christians are not supposed to be persecutors. And there may be a few individual Christians that do take an approach of persecuting people, but the Christian church has not gone to court to persecute anybody. If someone says, well, the church is standing against homosexual marriage, That's not persecuting anyone. That's just standing for what marriage is.
It's like you said, too, if they don't like it, they just move on to another person that agrees with them.
Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, they don't have to do business with Christians. And, I don't know. To my mind, it's just a persecution of Christians by a minority. And I think that all the court cases are basically test cases to show the hostility of the small group against the larger group. Because, let's face it, I mean, homosexuals have been disenfranchised by Christianity for the simple reason that Christianity does not approve of that particular mm-hmm. sin. It also doesn't approve of fornication or murder or other sins, but that doesn't make Christianity a persecutor of people who do those things. We're not supposed to be persecuting anybody. But
right. Well, it's like I was on Facebook because everybody's posting about vote for this R-74 law, and I just gave out my opinion and said, well, if it's going to pass, then you should allow polygamy and incest too, because there's two people, brother and sister, that love each other.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why should a gay people get married and they can't? But then on the other hand, I said that I disagree with that as well, though. And then I just got in this big argument on there with the person, and I said I love homosexuals, but I'm not going to vote for something that I disagree with. And then he started calling me a bigot.
Yeah, exactly. Well, of course.
And
I mean,
like, well, if it's something
you're called the bigot,
how?
You're called the bigot, but they're the ones who are intolerant.
Yeah. It's just really sad. And then you try and be loving and approach them with, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, it is ridiculous, and we're living in crazy times.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And you better be prepared for spiritual war and maybe for other steps. When I say other steps, I don't mean violent steps. I actually, there are times in history, we can't imagine it here in America, but there are times in history when all the Christians in a certain country had to leave to go somewhere safer. And of course, most Christians wouldn't recommend leaving America because they'd say, well, we need to retake America. Well, that's fine, if possible. You see, America's always been the country that they fled to. The Christians
right.
in Armenia, the Christians in Russia, the Christians in China, the Christians wherever, if they could, they fled, and they usually fled. A great number of them fled to America. America's always been the place to flee to. So far, it has not been the place to flee from, but there's certainly no guarantee that it won't be.
Yeah, exactly. Well, anyway, thank you for taking my call, and I got to get back to driving on the road here.
Okay, Gage, thanks for calling, and thanks for pulling
over. Thanks.
Okay.
Have a good one.
You too. Bye now. All right, let's talk to Mark from Beaverton. I give you another chance, Mark. Hi.
Hi, Steve. Sorry about that. I accidentally hung up.
Oh, okay.
I have a question about Matthew 10, verse 23.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus says, I tell you the truth, the Son of Man will return before you have reached all the towns of Israel. Is that return there talking about the second coming, or
no? But what translation are you reading?
The New Living.
That's interesting to hear it rendered that way. It's putting the phrases in a different order to almost make it sound like he's making a prediction about when he's going to come. The Son of Man will return before blah blah blah. But in fact, he's not so much making a prediction of when he's going to come. He's making a statement about the limitations on their time to reach the villages of Israel. A better translation would be, when they persecute you in this city, flee to another, for assuredly I say to you, you will not have gone through all the cities of Israel before the Son of Man comes. Now, he's talking to them about not wasting time as they go from village to village trying to evangelize the villages of Israel. He says, don't dilly-dally. If they persecute you somewhere and they're not receptive, go to another village. Keep moving, because you've got limits on your time. The emphasis here is not to make a prediction about when he's coming, but to make the statement their limits are on their time. And what is it that limits their time? Well, there's something coming that he calls the Son of Man coming. Now, of course, many of us, whenever we read of the Son of Man coming, we think of the second coming. But it doesn't always refer to the second coming. For example, in Matthew 16 and verse 28, Jesus said, assuredly I say to you, there are some standing here who shall not taste death till they see the Son of Man coming. Okay? So Jesus said, there's something he's calling the Son of Man coming, that some of them standing there would not see death before it happened. So in the lifetime of some of those people, this is not the second coming of Christ, because that didn't happen within their lifetime. And also, in Matthew 24, he said in verse 30, then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the land will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Okay, so there's a third time he talks about it. And in this case, he says in verse 34, assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away until all these things are fulfilled. So, three different times here he refers to the Son of Man coming. We could find another one in Matthew 26 where he says to Caiaphas, you will see the Son of Man coming on clouds and so forth. So here are passages which we might think should be applied to the second coming of Christ. But in fact, some of them cannot be, and perhaps none of them can be. In one case, Jesus said it would happen while some of them standing there were still alive, before they had died. In another place, he said this generation will not pass before it happens, which is saying the same thing, only in different words. And here in Matthew 10, he says, you will not have reached all the villages of Israel before the Son of Man comes. Whatever he is talking about is something that was going to happen in their lifetime, in their generation, and before they would have full opportunity to evangelize the whole of Israel. In other words, before all the villages would have been reached adequately. Now, what would that be? I've just said it's not the second coming of Christ, because that doesn't fit the predictions. But there are things that could be called the coming of Christ that could. Some people feel that the transfiguration is what Jesus was referring to in Matthew 16 when he said, some of you standing here will not taste death before you see the Son of Man coming. They say, well, right after that, about 8 days later, a few of the disciples went up on the Mount of Transfiguration and saw the glory of Christ, and that was them seeing the Son of Man coming. So they would say this reference in Matthew 16:28 to the Son of Man coming is a reference to the Transfiguration. Well, before we decide that's true, we need to ask, does that fit these others? This generation will not pass.
Especially the one about coming on the clouds. That sounds like the second coming to me. Were there clouds at the Transfiguration?
There was a cloud, actually. There, a cloud came and obscured Jesus. Remember, a cloud came down, and then when it lifted, Moses and Elijah were gone. But that's not the determining factor to my mind. To my mind, Jesus said that it would happen in their life, but he also said that it had something to do with their not being able to reach all the villages of Israel. So whatever the Son of Man coming is, seems to spell the end of their opportunity to reach the villages of Israel. And that might have something to do with the coming to an end of the nation of Israel and the Jews being carried away into captivity so that it's no longer possible to go and evangelize them in their villages. But also, you see, when Jesus spoke about this generation will not pass before they see the Son of Man come in the clouds, this was after the Mount of Transfiguration, he said that. So the likelihood that he's talking about the Mount of Transfiguration is not great, because it did not have any impact on their ability to reach the villages of Israel. Some people think the Son of Man coming is a reference to Pentecost, when the Spirit came. That's the Spirit of Christ coming. But again, some of these statements don't seem to fit that. But many people believe, and I'm going to lean this way myself, that the coming of the Son of Man is probably a reference to the judgment of Jerusalem and the destruction of the nation of Israel. And the Jews at that time were carried away into all lands, and Israel was depopulated. And this would be an event that would, in fact, preclude any further evangelization of the village of Israel. It also happened within the lifetime of some of them standing there, and therefore could well be what he's talking about. Now, the idea of this destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 being called the coming of the Son of Man might seem strange to people until we realize that the expression coming of the Lord, or the coming of God, or in this case, the coming of Christ, is a term that is used figuratively as well as literally in the Bible. It's used lots of different ways. For example, Jesus told the church of Ephesus in Revelation chapter 2, if you don't repent, I will come to you, and I will remove your lampstand from its place. Well, that must have happened because their lampstand is gone, but it wasn't the second coming. To another church, he said, I stand at the door and knock. Everyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come into him. Now, that's not talking about the second coming either. And there are some promises made to, or threats actually, made to the church of Pergamos and to the church of Sardis, saying that Jesus would come to them also. And these are churches that are now gone. In fact, the cities themselves are gone. So here we have a number of times Jesus talks about coming to certain groups, but he doesn't always mean the same thing. And in the Old Testament, God coming often meant he's judging. In one case in particular, the exact language that Jesus used about his own coming is used of God coming to Egypt. It's in Isaiah 19:1. And what it's actually describing is the judgment of Egypt in the form of the Assyrian invasion. You can read the chapter, Isaiah 19, and see that it's a description of the Assyrians coming and conquering Egypt, and it's the judgment of God. And in the language of the prophet, in Isaiah 19:1, he says, the Lord comes with a swift cloud and will come into Egypt. Or he says, the Lord rides on a cloud and comes to Egypt. So here we have God coming on a cloud to Egypt, but it's not really literally God coming on real clouds. It's a figure of speech. It's talking about the Assyrian armies coming to Egypt and conquering it. So, in other words, when the Bible talks about God coming or even Jesus coming, sometimes it's talking literally about his second coming or even about his first coming. But there's other times when it's being used figuratively to speak of some other kind of event, usually a judgment event. And even the reference to coming on clouds can be used in this way. As we saw in Isaiah 19:1, so that when Jesus said, you will not have reached all the villages of Israel before the Son of Man comes, or some of you standing here will not taste death before the Son of Man comes, or this generation will not pass until the Son of Man comes, I believe it could very well be referring to that event which happened within the lifetime of some of them, not all of them, and which brought about an end to their opportunity to reach the villages of Israel, and that would be the destruction of Jerusalem.
Okay, that helps a lot. I think what confused me about that was the mention of the clouds. When I hear clouds, I think of him coming in the sky at the second coming. But
of course,
I guess clouds can be kind of metaphorical for judgment in general, too.
They can be. Clouds are used a lot of different ways, too. Sometimes they talk about the literal clouds in the sky. Sometimes they talk about something else, but there's a lot of the imagery from the Old Testament being repeated in these statements of Jesus, and lots of people who are not very familiar with the Old Testament don't know what to do with it, and so they sort of take it literally when maybe it wasn't intended that way.
Okay. Thank you, Steve. That explanation helped me a lot.
Okay, Mark. Good talking to you.
You too. Bye.
Thanks for calling. Okay, bye now. Our next caller is Joel from Las Vegas, Nevada. Joel, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve, can you hear me all right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to, like Fred said, just kind of give a little brief comment. I found a book that said, the Lord is my shepherd and he knows that I'm gay. And I read that book. It was from a pastor. And so I traveled out there and I went to his church and I went inside and I became friends with one of the members there and invited him back for dinner and fellowship and stuff, you know, friendship and stuff. And then, we got into a discussion about the Bible and I brought out the verses that you and I know, and then soaked it in prayer, and hopefully, you know, he went back to his church and, you know, spread the true gospel to the people. I just wanted to make that comment.
All right. I appreciate your call, Joel.
Yeah, thank you.
All right. Bye now. All right. Another caller from Las Vegas. William is next. Hi, William. Welcome.
Hey, how's it going, Steve?
Good.
I like that one scripture where it talks about let those that are wicked remain wicked and those that are righteous be righteous. I think it's talking about the tares and the wheat. But I did want to make a comment on this, the homosexuality, the gay marriage thing. I'm thinking since it's been very popular and growing, you know, it would be good if a lot of gays and lesbians opened their own, like marriage places where other gays would just go there and get married instead of maybe going to a regular, like heterosexual church or marriage place and then like start, you know, like, hey, you know, you're going to get sued if you don't marry us. I mean, imagine if a Christian couple or a Buddhist or Hindu couple or a Muslim couple went to a gay marriage place and said, we want to get married. And they said, well, we're not going to marry you because you're not gay or you're not lesbian. And then the religious group said, well, we're going to sue you because you know, being lesbians or homosexuals won't marry us. You know, so I think it's a fringe thing. It's like you have Christians that are very outspoken and radical and are angry and can get, not violent, but get, you know, would seem that way. And then you have other Christians that are like, you know, they disagree, but they're not violent or threatening. Same thing with Muslims and I think gays. I know of gays that are like, hey, you know, if you want to go to church and believe in God, it's fine. You know, I don't care. It doesn't bother me. I won't even say anything. And then you have other gays that are very, you know, well, I'm going to sue you. I'm going to court because, you know, we're like on a roll now type of thing. And I think what's basically going to happen, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if suddenly, you know, religious groups start rioting, you know, and have been not necessarily violent, but like, you know, if you don't speak up, nothing will happen. Because, I mean, that's what the gays did. You know, they wanted to be gay, and so they spoke up, and a lot of them got more like, angry, some got violent, and then when you have enough of them doing that, then people listen, you know, whether it's right or wrong, it's you know, you pass the law, and then you have your sympathizers or your opposers. And I think with religious groups and Christians, that could happen in certain areas of the United States at certain times where some just like, hey, you know, we want our rights, you know, instead of, like you said earlier, a minority, you have one judge that can tell 100 people that's unconstitutional or you can't do that. You know, I thought a judge and politician is supposed to represent the people, not themselves versus the people.
Well, anyway, they're supposed to represent the Constitution.
Right.
And certainly there's nothing in the Constitution that says that people are being discriminated against by not being allowed to marry each other.
Right.
If two people are, you know, homosexuals, a couple, and they want to live in a life that other people call sin, well, as long as they're not hurting anybody else, they're allowed to do that. But that doesn't mean they have the right to redefine the cultural institutions. Just
right.
Like if a man wants to have an illicit relationship with, you know, his sister or with his neighbor's wife. The laws don't forbid him to do it, but he shouldn't be allowed to just redefine that as redefine marriage as to include that too.
Right.
You know, I mean, there is a certain definition of marriage. Adultery is not the same thing as marriage. Incest is not the same thing as marriage. Bestiality is not the same thing as marriage. Same sex, you know, same gender sex is not the same thing as marriage. Those things all exist. And most people, I think these days, people can get away with them legally, but that's not the same thing as being legitimately able to rename the institution of marriage to include their particular activities.
Right, right. I agree. Well, like you say, we're in a culture and a changing world that's, you know, definitely certain prophecies are being fulfilled. And like with the Christians, I think it's too, like that scripture is, you're in the world but not of the world. And I think throughout history, every empire that's gotten away from a moral, godly foundation into its definition of power and how everybody should be and their definition of morality or what's right and what's wrong, they came and they gone. And I think this country is no different. When it will peak, that remains to be seen. But, you know, again, back to the scripture, where it's let the wicked be wicked and let the righteous be righteous, the tares and the wheat, and then, you know, they will be separated and about the Lord's return and the judgment. I kind of think we're kind of into that right now, you know, because it talks about there will be apostasy first, falling away, you know, from the belief.
Okay. We're going a lot of different directions here. My lines are full, but I appreciate your thoughts.
Thanks, Steve.
Okay, William. Thank you. Brad from Kuski is next. Hi, Brad.
I figured I'd take this opportunity to make a comment.
Uh-huh.
This is when I'm very glad that and very much want Christians to be judges. Because if we have a Christian judge, he would be more likely to rule in favor of a person being sued by a homosexual couple or something. You know what I'm saying?
Well, maybe he would. Sometimes Christians don't do any better than non-Christians. I remember we had a judge in McMinnville once who was a Christian. And a Christian friend of mine was abandoned by his wife. She was living with some other guy. She was trying to sue him for the house and everything, and she had no justice in her side, and he was totally the victim, and their divorce was handled by this judge who was a Christian man, and he gave everything to the woman. I just thought, how could this man call himself a Christian? Well, apparently he just wanted to be politically correct or something, but the fact that someone's a Christian doesn't mean they know what they're doing. What we want is just people. Conscientious people as judges, people who will do the right thing, whether they're a Christian or not. Unfortunately, sometimes Christians don't do the right thing, and it's possible for a person who's not a Christian to do the right thing if he's an honest and conscientious person. What we lack in our courts too often are people who are willing to stand by, frankly, the constitutional rights of the citizens that they are whose cases they're judging. And therefore, judges who won't do that are, of course, dishonest men, whether they're Christians or not.
But there is an element of worldview, whereas if you're not a Christian, your worldview would be different as far as, like, see, some of these homosexual marriages are done because they want to have the rights of a married couple when it comes to, like, hospital visitation and things like
that. Well, in Washington State, they already had all that. That was already given to them years ago, yeah.
I understand that, yeah. But so a non-Christian could kind of see, could act justly, but act in a non-Christian worldview for a ruling. You see what I'm saying? Do you understand what I mean there?
Well, as you see, the thing is, I don't think anyone who's such a radical social engineer as to take an institution, namely marriage, which has had a certain definition for 6,000 years, and just say, well, you know, we're the first generation to be smarter than everyone else who's come, and we're just going to throw that right out the window, and we're going to experiment and see what this does to society. That is, first of all, unmitigated hubris. It is also dangerously experimental. And frankly, we don't have very smart people, only very arrogant people running our country at this point.
I think one last thing. The chances are better that you'll get a good, righteous judgment if the judge is a Christian rather than if he's not.
Boy, I hope that's true. I don't know. I mean, a lot of the Christians are people, let's just say people who call themselves Christians, since really, I mean, if we're talking about a real Christian who's really following Jesus, yeah, they won't make any unjust judgments if they see the case clearly. But the churches are full of people who would say they're Christians, and yet they would rule like non-Christians because they're essentially non-Christians in sheep's clothing.
But if you look back through history, in societies where Christians are judges, their rulings are better, like ours were a few hundred years ago and even 100 years ago.
Well, you know what we had back then? I think we had, in many cases, smarter people and better people, whether they were Christians or not. I think a lot of the non-Christians who were in power 100 years ago were better than a lot of the people in power who might even call themselves Christians today, because they had more common sense, they had more sense of decency and justice, and you know, it's not always the case that people who wear the tag or the label Christian are going to really be smart enough or even good enough to rule a country, to rule other people. And certainly most non-Christians are not. But I would say that I would look for a ruler.
Wouldn't you say chances are better, though, if it's a Christian ruler, that he would be just more than a non-Christian ruler?
Probably. That's probably the case. Unfortunately, those who call themselves Christians are, you know, their quality of Christian living is deteriorating rather fast. But I think it's mostly because they're not really Christians. But you're right. The people who don't call themselves Christians to a very large degree are really adrift without an anchor, and really are morally, you know, blind in many cases. So at least somebody who has some respect for the Word of God would be safer than someone who doesn't.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks, Steve, for taking my comment.
Okay, Brad, thanks for your call.
Take care.
Bye now. All right, James from Everett, Washington is next. James, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve, for taking my call. The subject you're talking about, I could talk to you about for hours and hours, but that's not what I called about. I called about different kinds of Bibles. I'm doing Bible research and things.
Uh-huh.
But of course, you have the King James. But my question is, like, on the Exegesis Bible, the Marian Bible, and the Septuagint. Could you explain or tell me, you know, in what order they came or what the differences are?
Okay, you said the Exegesis Bible,
yeah,
the Septuagint, and what other one?
And I saw one yesterday, and called the Marian. It's a very ancient book they had. I couldn't afford it, but it's called the Marian Bible.
M-A-R-I-A-N?
It's M-A-R-I-A-N-N-E, I believe. It's a Holy Bible.
Okay.
This book was ancient. It's worth, you know, they had it locked up.
Okay,
Okay,
I've never heard of the Exegesis Bible. Now, the Septuagint is simply a translation of the Old Testament from the original Hebrew into Greek. Although now you can get the Septuagint, of course, translated from the Greek into English. Mm-hmm. But the Septuagint was made almost 300 years before Christ, and therefore it does not include the New Testament.
Okay.
It was simply the first time any book that we know of was ever translated from one language to another, and it happened to be the Bible, the Old Testament, that was translated from the original Hebrew into Greek, because Greek had become the common language of the whole Mediterranean world, and a group of 70 Alexandrian Jews decided it was time to get their Bible translated into the language that people were reading. And so we have the Greek Septuagint. It's really just the Greek Old Testament. Now, I have on my shelf, and probably you saw for sale, a Septuagint that's translated into English. That is not going to include the New Testament, so it's not a complete Bible.
Okay.
Whether it's a good Old Testament compared to the others, I'm not really able to say. Some people think that the Septuagint preserves a more ancient reading of some of the passages in the Old Testament than our Hebrew manuscripts do. Others disagree with that. So, not being a scholar, I can't tell you which. Although I have plenty of confidence in the Hebrew manuscripts we have, and probably in the Septuagint also. There'd be only slight differences for the most part, I would think, in terms of what information you'd get from them. Then, as far as exegesis, Bob, I've never heard of that. Is that?
Not Jesus, like the name Jesus, but it's exegesis.
I know what exegesis is, yeah.
I never heard of it until yesterday when I was out doing some research.
Okay.
I saw the Marian Bible. I wasn't sure what it was, but they had it locked up. It's pretty old and pretty expensive.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. But there's a man there
looking for it, this exegesis Bible, and they told him it was out of print. It's been out of print for like 100 years, but they're going to try to find a copy.
Okay. Well, exegesis Bible would be a Bible, probably a study Bible, where someone had done exegetical notes in it. Exegesis simply means drawing the meaning out of a text.
Oh,
and
okay.
so So anytime somebody is studying the Bible and doing a good job of interpreting it, what they're doing is exegeting, or it's that they're engaged in what's called exegesis.
Oh, okay. I didn't know what that meant.
Yeah. Yeah, so exegesis is really a process of studying the Bible, and it usually involves, you know, well, what it does involve is seeking to draw from the text its meaning by appeal to, you know, the best language considerations of Greek and Hebrew, the meaning of words, the context of things, the background. Anytime you get some kind of information that's going to help you get under the skin of the writer of a passage and understand what he's getting at, you're involved in exegesis.
Okay, I've never heard of it. I mean, I've heard the word, but I didn't.
Right, but if you're thinking of buying a Bible, I guess exegesis Bible, if it hasn't been in print for 100 years, is not going to be an option for you, nor the Marian Bible. But the Bibles that are available include many that are just very good.
Oh yeah, I've got many Bibles in the. Yeah, you know, my main Bible, one I read and study, is the King James, of course.
Uh-huh.
But I guess I get my concordances and stuff, and I'm not an educated theologian at all.
Sure.
I've talked to you before. I've only come to the Lord about 5 years ago, but I'm just so wrapped up into it. I just keep more and more knowledge. I'm trying to learn, you know.
Yeah.
And I hear these words. Excuse me. And I'm not sure what they are.
Well, most of those are words I had never heard of, that particular exegesis Bible or the Marian Bible, but I mean, I guess I'm not studying ancient translations so much. And I'm more interested in a translation directly from the Greek and the Hebrew into our own language. And there are a number of those that are worthwhile. But I would also suggest, if you're not wanting to fully trust an English translation, that you would, in addition to getting a decent translation, you should maybe get an interlinear Greek-Hebrew New Testament, an interlinear Hebrew-English Old Testament. You can buy these quite readily online, and it's called the Interlinear Bible. What they do is they have the actual Hebrew text with the Hebrew letters and the actual Greek text with the Greek letters of the New Testament, and they have over each word a very close English literal equivalent, so that you can actually look up any passage and see what words are really there in the text and which ones are not, compared to whatever translation you're using.
Because I started, not a collection, but you know, I studied the Bibles and stuff, and like one of the things I noticed, a lot of these new Bibles, I'm not interested in them. They change the words around, and you know, one of the first things I do is I pick it up and go to 1 John. And some of these newer versions of these Bibles, and you know, the first verse is completely different.
Yeah.
I said, whoa, what are they talking about?
All right. Well, brother, the whistling has begun. The show has begun to wind down.
Well, thank you for taking my call, and I enjoy it so much. I've learned so much from you.
Thank you, James. It's good hearing from you.
Have a good day. And Lord be with you.
You too. God bless you. Well, you've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. I host the program Monday through Friday, twice a day. Now, many of you know about the afternoon program you're listening to right now that's just ended. You may not know there's a morning program as well every day. Not on the same stations, however. Some stations carry the morning program and some carry the afternoon program. But you can catch both programs on the Internet. They both stream from our website, and they also both are archived at our website. So you can listen to either or both programs live or later from our website. The Narrow Path is a listener-supported ministry, and if you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can find that address at our website, or you can just donate from the website if you prefer. The website is www.thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.